It's really always a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for that beautiful song. Well, many of you know Robert Trent Vidson, member of this congregation, and also the Francis L. and Edwin L. Cummings Professor of History and Africana Studies at William & Mary, as well as the President-elect of the Association for the Study of the Worldwide African Diaspora. I reached out to Robert as I was preparing for this service to ask him for his recommendations on what I should be reading, what is the best current scholarship that I should be soaking up about the 1619 African landing and what it means for us today. Well, Robert shared some very helpful book recommendations, and he also sent me, as a sort of by the way, a video of a talk he gave this past February about the African landing at the spring convocation at Bowie State University, which is a historically black public university in Maryland. I watched the video, and I was spellbound. It was immediately clear to me that this, in fact, was the sermon that this congregation needed to hear today. Robert is at Fort Monroe today participating in the first African landing commemorative events, so he was not able to join us here today, but he has graciously given us permission to screen this video today. It's about 15 minutes long, so afterwards I will share a brief response. Let us watch it together.
And it's appropriate that we start at this starting point, at the start of Black History Month. Of course, we know in early August 1619, a monumental event happened in a place called Jamestown, very small and fledgling colony. And that event, historians tell us, was the first representative assembly of English colonists. For many historians and scholars and the millions of tourists and school children who come to the site of Jamestown, just a few miles away from my house, they celebrate this representative governing assembly of white men, propertied white men only, as the birthplace of American democracy and freedom. Less remarked upon, but I would argue far more significant, is an event that happened later that same month, in August 1619. And that was the arrival of those 20 and odd Negroes coming off those two ships. And up to now, we have known very little about who those 20 and odd Negroes were, but we know now that they came from West Central Africa. We know that they came from states, the Congo and Ndongo. And when we tell the story that has slavery at the center of it, we always have to remember that the history of black people do not start with slavery. We always have to remember that Africa is the cradle of humankind, and that long before this story that I'm telling you today, there were great ancient African civilizations. The cradle of humankind and earlier African diasporas, migrations of people coming out of the continent of Africa to people the world. And we know about the civilizations of Egypt and Nubia and Ethiopia and Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Zimbabwe. And I can go on and on and on and on. And so we bring that story to the civilizations of Congo and Ndongo in West Central Africa. And we know that beginning in the late 15th century, the Portuguese initiated diplomatic and economic relationships with Congo first and then Ndongo. And we know that there was a great economic and cultural exchange with Congolese and Ndongolese going to Portugal and Portuguese coming to West Central Africa. But we also know too that by the late 16th century, the Portuguese were interested in also enslaved people, partially to populate their new colony of Brazil in the Western Hemisphere, but also to fulfill contractual obligations to deliver enslaved people to Spanish colonies throughout North, South America and Central America and the Caribbean. These contractual obligations known as the asiento. And this is where the story of Angela, we actually have names of some of the people who came across the water and eventually landed in Jamestown. Angela came out of what we believe Ndongo. And she was one of the 350 people who boarded a Portuguese slaver, the São João Batista, in English, St. John the Baptist. And Angela, one of those 350 people captured in the interior of West Africa, beginning a long middle passage, first before you hit the water, marching to the sea, overland, being held in the barracoons, leaving the port of Luanda, making their way across the water. There, before they left, as they embarked on this slave ship, they were blessed by a priest who now said that their enslavement actually opened the door to their Christian salvation. And we know that by the time Angela and her fellow captives boarded the St. John the Baptist in 1619, we know that already 500,000 enslaved Africans had already made their way across the water, beginning in 1502, to again provide labor, captive labor, for Spanish colonies and Portuguese colonies in the Americas. So while they might have been the first to come to what became Jamestown, they were not the first to cross the water. Already 500,000 had come. And they would not be the last, because we know that in the entirety of the Atlantic slave trade, from 1502 to 1870, 12 to 15 million enslaved Africans crossed the water to make that middle passage. And we know about the horrors of the middle passage. This is serious business, but this is honoring our ancestors who made their way through. We know that they were chained together in the holds of these slave ships. We know that they suffered from a lack of adequate food and fresh water. We know they suffered from disease. We know that women particularly, their bodies were violated by crew members. We know that perhaps 20% did not survive the voyage. And can we imagine that all that we are as parents, as children, as brothers and sisters, all that we are as our identity could be stripped away to be remade as chattel, as commodities to be used for someone else's labor. Imagine the trauma, physical, emotional, mental, that's happening to Angela and her fellow captives on the St. John the Baptist. And we know that this is the age of sail, and so it could take many months sometimes to cross the waters, depending on the currents and the winds. And in this case, the San Juan Batista, the St. John the Baptist, seemed to run low of fresh food and water. And they made a stop on their way to Veracruz, the Spanish colony, what is now Mexico. On their way there, they had to stop in Jamaica. And there, to get the fresh supplies that they needed, they sold 24 children in Jamaica. And then we know that St. John the Baptist left Jamaica en route to Veracruz. But we know that they didn't make it before being intercepted by two English ships, the Treasurer and the White Lion, one having a Dutch license. The Dutch and the Spanish were at war, and so the Dutch wanted to take some of Spanish wealth by raiding Spanish ships. And we know in the battle that happened with these two pirating ships and the St. John the Baptist, those two ships took off about 60 enslaved people, took them for themselves, took other supplies off that ship, and then sent the St. John the Baptist on its way to Veracruz. Out of those 60, taken off to send St. John the Baptist were Angela and her fellow captives that eventually made it, landed first at Point Comfort, what is now Hampton. And I always have to mention this because I live right next to Hampton, and the folk at Hampton get very upset with me when I start with Jamestown and don't mention Point Comfort, Hampton. It started there. And then they made their way up to Jamestown. Some of those enslaved people went to the second English colony, Bermuda. But the 20 and odd Negroes, including Angela, eventually made their way to Jamestown. And so the question has been debated amongst historians, what was their status? Were they enslaved in Jamestown? Or were they regarded as servants, which the records tell us, servants? Well, we don't have time for a long, scholarly argument. I just want to tell you that it seems clear that those 20 and odd Negroes were bought from that ship. Already enslaved, they were bought. And we also know that even though some, like Anthony and Mary Johnson, became free landowners, very prosperous landowners, they seem to be the exception rather than the rule. And we see this very early on in the colony. For instance, 1640, three servants, two white and one black, ran away from their master. They seem to be indentured servants, meaning, particularly if you were from England or Ireland, you served a period of indenture, several years of labor, 4 to 7 years, and then you would be freed from that labor, and so theoretically you could be a property owner and a citizen of the colony. That option did not seem to be there for those black servants. And we have an example. I'll just give you one. In 1640, two white servants and one black servant ran away from their master. And they came to Maryland, by the way, and they were brought back. And when they were brought back, they all suffered a punishment, 30 lashes, physical punishment. But the two whites were given an additional year of indenture in addition to their 30 lashes. The black man, John Punch, received his 30 lashes, but also received the additional punishment of lifetime servitude. And so we see laws developing in this colony. I'll give you a few examples. One in 1662, making slavery hereditary. And law after law develops so that European indentured labor begins to go away and African enslaved labor picks up. And so what develops in Virginia is the development of a slave society, and that reproduces itself in South Carolina and in my home state of New York as well. It was in the North, too. And we go forward in time to think about the fact that Jamestown and those 20 and odd Negroes began a process whereby, by 1860, the United States of America had the largest slave society in world history. 4 million people enslaved. What is the importance of Jamestown and why does it matter? We see in the story of the 20 and odd Negroes, we are reminded of their African backgrounds. But we also know in their stories that they came into a storm, the storm of the Atlantic slave trade. And once their middle passage was finished, their troubles were far from over. Because coming into this new colony of Jamestown, they came in as enslaved people. And they maintained a subordinated position of servitude. And it wasn't just their individual slavery, but because slavery eventually became hereditary, the children inherited that status of slavery. And this is remarkable because slavery existed all over the world long before the Atlantic slave trade. We find slavery in all ancient civilizations as well: China, Rome, Greece, Egypt. In fact, the term slave comes from Slav, Eastern European peoples enslaved in the medieval Europe. So slavery up to this time had not been racially exclusive in any way. But the Atlantic slave trade and American slavery was unique by making slavery racial, creating hierarchical racial systems, and creating ideas of white supremacy and black inferiority that survived even the end of legal slavery. So when we talk about the 20 and odd Negroes, including Angela, we honor, we remember, we don't celebrate, obviously, right? And we don't treat it as an anniversary so much, because anniversary is like a wedding anniversary, something positive. We remember, we reflect, we honor the fact that they made it through the storm, found a way out of no way. So the most important story of August 1619 is not the birthplace of democracy. We still have a lot of trouble with democracy. Democracy is a rather new thing when we consider African Americans. We know we did not have voting rights until after the Civil War, and even then they were stripped away. And we know that fully for African Americans. African American women did not have the right to vote in 1920 when white women were able to get the right to vote. And we know with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 might have been the first time that there wasn't a full opening where we could talk about a representative democracy. But we know too that recent Supreme Court decisions have stripped away, gutted the Voting Rights Act. And we know about all the methods of voter suppression: gerrymandering, closing poll stations in predominantly African American communities, purging voter rolls. So our democracy is fragile. And the democratically elected governor of Virginia, a person I voted for, has trouble explaining away why it is that images of a Ku Klux Klan person and another person in blackface showed up on his page in medical school. The legacies of white supremacy remain, even with our democratically elected officials. And there's an elephant in the room that I have not mentioned when we talk about our democratically elected officials. So in closing then, the most important feature of August 1619 was not the so-called first representative governing assembly that gave birth to the American democracy and freedom. The most important event of August 1619 was the coming of those 20 and odd Negroes, and we looked far more at them, far more than chattel, units of labor, but as people who were enslaved and who persevered and had great strength and resilience to remake their identities and make a life for themselves. That is our heritage. That gives us context as we go through our personal struggles to think about whose shoulders we stand on. That is the lasting legacy. These first African Americans, the beginning of an African diaspora here in America. That is our legacy. That is what we stand on. And that is what we remember on this day. Thank you very much.
And those wounds are still with us. Those 20 and odd human souls dragged from their homes and brought to these shores, this place that we call home today. Those human beings who made a way out of no way who suffered unimaginable trauma and yet resisted all the efforts of their captors to make them into anything besides human beings who deserve to be free. That resistance, that resilience, that strength and courage, as Robert told us, that is what we celebrate today, even as we mourn the deep, deep sorrow and traumatization that has been visited upon too many generations of African Americans in this same country, on this same land, which continues to haunt us all. And in the words of the hymn, oh my Lord, what shall we do? But we have an opportunity today, an opportunity that is always with us, that calls to us with a particular urgency today as we observe this 400-year commemoration. An opportunity to practice our own resistance, our own resilience, strength, and courage to say enough. 400 years of suffering is long enough. It is time for a new way of living. And so I call on each and every one of you today to ask yourself, what can I do to honor those 20 and odd human souls? What can I do? And what will I do? What will I do? I want to tell you about two commitments that I personally am making on this day. First of all, I commit in this coming year to reach out to the folks of color in this congregation. First of all, to offer my personal support to each of you. And second, I promise to personally support and encourage the formation of a group for people of color in this congregation, or whatever form of support or networking that RWU folks of color would like to experiment with. I commit to listening to you, taking what you say seriously, and partnering with you to help this congregation live even more fully into our vision of welcoming all people. That is my first commitment today. My second commitment is that I have made a promise to myself this year, and now to you, to learn more about trauma, and in particular, the kind of trauma that has its roots in racism and other forms of oppression. In particular, I'm going to be studying the work of two trauma therapists who identify as people of color. The first one is Resma Menekem. This is his book, My Grandmother's Hands. It's about how trauma lives in our bodies and how we can help heal that using our bodies. And the second book is by Laura Vandermeer Lipsky. It's called Trauma Stewardship, An Everyday Guide to Caring for Self While Caring for Others. So I'm going to be studying their work because I want to be a better minister to anybody who has experienced trauma, which is a lot of us, and especially to folks of color who, even now, as we know, are having to navigate a political and a social climate which seems to be doing its best to re-traumatize people on almost a daily basis. Those are my commitments today. And I ask you, what will your commitment be? How will you answer the call of those 20 and odd souls who came to Jamestown 400 years ago? There are so many right answers to this question. You will know what is right for you. Be kind to yourself and each other along the way, but do something. Maybe you will be moved to go to a meeting of All Together, or come on the Motown Museum field trip to build connections and learn along with people who care about racial healing. Maybe you will commit to some aspect of personal healing. Maybe you will get more involved in politics as this pivotal election year approaches. Just do something. Be part of the great movement for healing and liberation, which is calling all of us in this moment. Share the light you have. Welcome the light that others will bring. Welcome the light of healing into your heart and into this heart of this land, so that the next 400 years will become a story of hope and redemption for all. May this be so. Blessed be, and amen.